Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I've been reflecting lately on just how much we tend to get swept up by the speculation, projection, trying to figure things out, trying to have an answer for things, and how much or how refreshing the Buddha's approach is in coming back to kind of the essentials of the what is it that helps the mind become clear, the heart become peaceful. And there's a discourse where the Buddha is approached by a wanderer in another sect, and he's asked by him about all the different speculative views that were current during that time. Is the world eternal, is it not eternal? You know, is it finite, is it infinite? Is the body one thing, the soul another? Are they the same thing? What happens to an enlightened being after they die? Do they exist? Do they not exist? Do they both exist or not exist? Do they neither exist or not? All the permutations of speculation, trying to find some solid ground either in the world outside or the world inside of our views, our own speculations about our sense of self, sense of I. And each time the Buddha was asked the question, and the Buddha said, well, it's not what I teach. And I think finally, in frustration, you know, the wanderer kind of says, "Well, you know, what do you, you know? Do you teach anything?" And the Buddha basically says, "Oh, well, you know, I teach a path of liberation, freedom from suffering, having a appropriate way of practice, and realization of Nibbana." Then the wanderer says, well, so if somebody practices that way, you know, just the, or, you know, given that you have this way of practice or this teaching, and you know, does the whole world get enlightened, or half of them, or a third of them? And I think the Buddha just got fed up at that point and didn't engage and didn't say anything. Finally, Ananda is worried that he's going to the wanderer is going to be think that the Buddha doesn't actually know anything, and Ananda is just kind of concerned because he's tuned in. Actually, it's, you know, he's just asking a very similar question. It's a speculative question, and the Buddha's not biting. And Ananda gives an image of saying, you know, people might understand similes better than just some kind of pronouncement. And says it's if, hey, there was a fortified city, and with its ramparts and walls and protective barriers, and a wise person who was the watchman knowing that there weren't any chinks or cracks or any way for anything to enter or get out of that city, and said that nothing bigger than a cat could get in. And the wise watchman, knowing the people who come and go, that they would keep out strangers and let in the people who he was familiar with. And in that way, knowing that anybody who was entered or left the city had to come by the sort of the one gate, the one doorway in. And then he said, in a similar way, in the Buddha's teachings, anybody who has ever been awakened, who is in the process of being awakened, and who will be awakened in the future, will all go in by the way of freeing the heart from five hindrances that are tendencies that cloud awareness and obstruct discernment. And they will rely on the cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness, and they will cultivate the seven factors of awakening. And though that is the way that all any beings that have ever been awakened in the past or liberated in the past, that are being liberated in the present, and anybody in the future, that is what they have to do. And I think that's, again, the Buddha brings things, and the Buddha's teachings bring things back to a practical exercise that we're not, it's not necessary to figure out the world, although one lives in the world responsibly. One doesn't need to get entangled in philosophical debate. But what one does do is pay attention to those hindrances that cloud awareness, obstruct our discernment. So that paying attention to those qualities, say, sense desire, that say obsessed, when the mind is obsessed or caught up with gratification, seeking stimulation, excitement, pleasure, it keeps the mind off balance. There isn't a foundation of stability there. Whenever the mind gets caught in its aversion, ill will, irritation, getting upset because of something one doesn't like, the mind's off balance. It's clouded. It's isn't able to really discern things in their true nature. We get stuck in some kind of bias, and that's whether it's a bias of a preference in terms of what we like, what we want, what we approve of, or what we are averse to. We get swept up in that, and from the Buddha's perspective, that's a hindrance. It's an obstruction. The hindrance of sloth and torpor, dullness, the mind being kind of slow and turgid. I would say that when the mind isn't able or willing to engage and be sharp and clear, then it's a hindrance. And we have to develop the tools that allow us to see clearly. Of course, its opposite is when the mind gets caught in restlessness, worry, agitation in terms of not able to settle. Just learning how to settle the mind is essential. Learning how to not get swept up in that kind of restless worry, speculation, what if, what it could be. And the last hindrance of doubt. Doubt, uncertainty, wavering. So those are tendencies that we all have, that we've all experienced or experience. So that in terms of, say, meditation, spiritual practice, from the Buddha's perspective, we have to work with those qualities first. And of course, the tools that the Buddha gives are the foundations of mindfulness. And it's important to recognize that when we're cultivating mindfulness, that it's not just an aloof noting of experience or a kind of bare awareness, unbiased attention. Those it's kind of an idealized version that doesn't quite match what the Buddha is pointing to. Because it's one's picking up this natural ability of the mind and necessary function of the mind to pay attention, and then cultivating it there's a certain description that the Buddha always gives when he's describing mindfulness. One is Ajahn Jeff uses a translation, ardent, so that there's an effort there, there's engagement, it's not just passive. There's an engagement and an application of effort that's needed in order to bring into being the skillful, wholesome qualities. There's an effort and an application of energy there that is required in terms of relinquishing, and one is recognizing and then relinquishing unskillful tendencies, unhelpful qualities that come into being, to be able to relinquish them, to not just, say, passively observe. It's like recognizing the hindrances as a hindrance. This is a hindrance. This is dullness. This isn't just something to passively observe and absorb into. Or this is irritation. Isn't just sort of passively observe and not recognize one's responsibility and not getting caught in it. So that sense of, there's an ardency there. One's doing something. It was like the talk I gave last night. The Buddha's own description of his teachings as a kiriyavanta, a teaching of action, engagement, putting forth of effort, taking responsibility for one's actions. And so that sense of ardency is one's engaged. The Buddha is also, description of that the Buddha always uses is in terms of alert. There's an alertness, a clear comprehension that's required for mindfulness to be, say, properly engaged. So again, not a passive kind of whatever, but a necessity of having appropriate attention, wise attention. I mean, it's interesting that also that, that say, with when we think of those four foundations of mindfulness, oftentimes we think of them as say, objects. And they are, to a certain degree. I mean, they are objects of attention. But just in the structure of the word that the Buddha uses, another equally valid way of say, translating it or describing it, is, say, an establishing of, like these four establishings of mindfulness. And so that they're a process that you engage in. So that engaging in the process of being alert, being attentive, being mindful, directing attention. So that establishing of the attention and the mindfulness on the body, on feelings, on mind, objects of mind. What is it? What are we engaging with, and how are we engaging? So that sense of this establishings of mindfulness. And these are things that we say again, something that we do, as opposed to that we're just taking as an object and being aware in a somewhat neutral way. There's another part of that description of say the classic description of that the Buddha gives of when we're of the establishings of mindfulness, ardent, alert, mindful. But then there's that sense of not being caught up in the habit of the mind, and to be caught up in its likes and its dislikes, its desires and its aversions. Because that's how we create our world, is what we pay attention to. And if it's just out of habit, or out of getting swept up in what other people, because it's easy to get swept up in say the biases of the world around us, and then we don't have an independence, and that's what say that mindfulness gives us the opportunity to be independent. That's one of the goals or the benefits that the Buddha points to, is that we can live independent and established in a sense of wisdom and peace. And of course that's where those seven factors of awakening come in, that active engagement in the cultivation of balancing qualities within the mind. Of course, then mindfulness forms the very first quality, and it's really your major balancing quality, the aspect of investigation of phenomena, investigation of what our experiences are, application of effort, putting forth of energy, experience of joy or rapture or exhilaration. Because when we start to see things clearly, there is an exhilaration. It brightens the mind. Then then to also learn how to balance that in terms of a calming, settling aspects of tranquility, that sense of tranquility, a firm establishing of the mind, settling of the mind, equanimity, balance. So these are using these different qualities we're finding our way of how this is for the fulfillment of what the Buddha is saying. Yeah, this is for the overcoming of suffering, overcoming of difficulty and distress, establishing of peace, the realization of an ultimate goal, nibbana, and nibbana being a place of true liberation, experience of real freedom. So these are, coming back, the foundations of experience as opposed to speculation and conjecture. How do we experience that? What's the result of it? How to foster that aspiration? Because we all aspire to something that is peaceful or happy or fulfilling in some way. And there isn't anybody that aspires to, you know, how can I be more miserable and discontent? I mean, it's a natural aspiration. But then, again, it's just so easy to get caught up in speculation, proliferation. The mind takes things and runs with it. And so being able to have an anchor for to be able to tune in to what the heart really seeks. It's like the Buddha's makes this very broad assessment of saying, yeah, there's two results of suffering. One is more suffering, but the other is a noble search. Learning how to nurture and to support that opportunity for a noble search for within that we all aspire to that, and to learn to cultivate and support that. To offer that for reflection this evening. Sadhu Karam Vidamase Sadhu.